Welcome to New Realities. I'm Alan Steinfeld, and this program is about the revolution in mind, body, spirit, how people who are waking up to who they really are understanding there's not really a separation between mind, body, and spirit, and there's people in this field who are initiators of this thought and founders of new movement. And I'm talking to Henry Grayson today, who's the founder of the Association for Spirituality and Psychotherapy. He understands really the intricacies of mind-body medicine. His book is called Use Your Body to Heal Your Mind. Welcome to the program, Henry.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Yeah, I'm interested in your roots of this mind and body and how you connect it to spirit. What was your background and how did you get into this idea of this connection?
Well, it's various segments to that. Because first of all, I'd been brought up in a very narrow religious background in the Southeast. And then when I went through college and I was ready to leave, I felt like I just wanted to find the most liberal place in the world. So I went to Boston to graduate school and I fled from the Deep South because I wanted not that rigid religion, the rigid racism and the rigid politics that I grew up with there. So now on one hand, I think it's probably been useful to me to have had that experience, because it made me much more sensitive to not be entrenched or moved toward being in any kind of doctrinaire kind of approach about anything, that I did not want that bondage anymore. But then
so
in terms of my spirituality...
But I just want to get back to that for 1 second. So you saw the awful... degradation of that kind of understanding, those kind of mental positions, right? Is that what
exactly?
Uh-huh.
Exactly.
Getting into spirituality, yes.
And even before I left the South, I was very much involved with the Martin Luther King family. In fact, Martin Luther Jr.'s younger brother became a good friend of mine, and I knew Martin Luther Sr. In fact, I was, after both of his sons were killed, I was the first one he let himself do his mourning or grief work with. And so I was very much involved in that part, and I'm amazed that my house did not get blown up at that time in Atlanta, Georgia, blacks coming and going to my house.
Were you a therapist back then in the 60s?
At that point, I was actually not a therapist. I went through theology school before I went into psychology.
Oh, okay.
And,
so that's
once I got into... theology school, then I began to experience more of the doctrinaire kind of things, and I became much more of an agnostic while being there, because I did not like the idea of the concept of God, of being some creature up in the sky that could reward and punish you.
Right.
And so I began to react against that particular kind of theology, you know, the theism, which means an external deity. And so from there, but the good part about it, when I took a course in pastoral counseling, that's what made me see that psychology, oh, now I see how psychology could help people.
Uh-huh.
And that's what inspired me to want to go for graduate work and a doctorate in psychology.
So then how did you integrate your theology work with your psychology work?
Well, I can't say I did. I integrated the theology part because I reacted against the theology. But what I did do is I brought the part that a sense of deep ultimate concern, as Paul Tillich put it, that I did bring from my history in the South, that there's something of value and meaning in this deeper sense of meaning. And that part I brought with me. But my spirituality emerged more in a strange way. After I'd finished my doctorate and came to New York to do postdoctoral training and had become a therapist for a number of years, I went to a training seminar with physicist David Bohm in New York. Mm-hmm. I'd begun to be a little interested in quantum physics, and I read some of that, and somebody told me he was coming to town and you might enjoy it. I never imagined I was going to experience what I did, though.
What was that? That sounds very interesting.
Because he's the one that wrote Wholeness and the Implicate Order. And he's the physicist that saw the interconnectedness of everything. And I went through that, and I remember the first day of that seminar, boy, my mind was just blown, so to speak, which is a good news because it blew out a lot of the old kind of concepts and worldview. And I got up on Sunday morning to go back, and I felt the strongest urge to go to church. And I hadn't felt that in maybe many, many years, if ever. And I thought, what's this about? And how can I go back to the scientific meeting, missing part of it, saying I'd been to church? Right. But I thought, let me trust that intuition, because I'd long since learned to do that. And so I thought, well, I'll stop by Fifth Avenue Presbyterian Church in Manhattan, because I live nearby there, because a friend had told me you should go sometime because they got the best music in town, the best church music. And since you used to be a musician and singer and conductor, they said you'd probably enjoy it. And so I decided to go, but the most unexpected thing happened. I started interpreting all the scriptures, all the words to the hymns, the creeds, the sermon. I started interpreting all those things in light of the new physics and the interconnectedness of everything. And I thought, boy, I felt like a whole new world, a whole new universe was just opening up to me. And I was so deeply moved by it, I sat there with tears rolling down my face the whole time, because I brought the concept from quantum physics into spirituality, and I never interpreted any of the religious thoughts or statements in that light before. And so when I brought those two together, I felt like this was an immense awakening that I'd had.
And it was an awakening. It was as if another part of your brain had opened up.
Exactly.
And then you went back, and how were you, to the David Bohm meeting, and what happened? I mean, what was
your... Well, that's amazing, too, because I was a little embarrassed to go back and tell people that I couldn't contain myself. And after a while, I shared it with the group. And virtually everyone there, Jew, Christian, agnostic, atheist, all there, said, I'm just so jealous of what you did. I had a similar urge this morning. I wish I'd had some way to honor it the way you did.
Wow. So where did you think that came from, that urge to do that, that affected so many people? Was because he talked about some deep spiritual truth, David Bohm?
Just the awareness that we're not really separate. God's not separate up in the sky somewhere.
You know, I just have this...
We're part of that consciousness that we call God. And my true self is part of that, cannot be separate from it. Even as Albert Einstein put it, it's just an optical illusion that we're separate.
I just had this conversation with Deepak Chopra today, who wrote a book called The Future of God, and he's one of the great communicators of our time, but he's speaking from that same place, that there's no separation. There's no old man in the sky with a beard judging us. I mean,
that's right.
Lots of people are saying this, but how do we live into that reality like you did? I mean, how do we turn on the rest of the world, which will, counteract the fundamentalists who believe the doctrines at face value instead of the symbolic representation of the spirit itself? I mean, how do we activate? Yeah.
Well, I don't think our goal is to try to change them, because that means I'm just trying to fix other people or change people, and that's not really very loving, actually. That's not being very spiritual when I'm trying to change somebody else. But I think I like the way Gandhi put it. He says, be the change you want to see. So our task, I think, is to be that loving presence in the world, to be kindness, to be forgiveness, all of those qualities that we would attribute to an external flat earth sky god. And if we think of God as having qualities like is omnipotent or omniscient or all-loving or all-knowing, okay, those are not just to be projected onto a sky god. Those are to be embraced. That's who I am too. That's who you are. That's who we all are. We just deny it. We disown it most of the time.
So in working in your therapy practice, how, people come in for, a whole range of problems. How do you apply that message and understanding to the people that you see?
Well, the first thing is not to preach to them. that's not the way that you would reach them. again, it's the same thing I was talking about before, is by being that.
So someone comes in with a lot of problems.
With people is what's really most important. And then gradually I can see if there are places where they're ready to awaken or open their minds to another dimension. Some people come in with tremendous readiness. Others are far from being ready. And the whole range in between. And so I need to be sensitive about where they are and what they're ready to understand. Sometimes people will get to it if I share things from quantum physics first, that worldview of quantum mechanics, and to see, talk about the interconnectedness of everything, or to talk about how physicists are now saying, in contrast to the old Newtonian worldview, when the only thing that was real is what you can experience with your five senses and measure it. Whereas in the quantum worldview, it's consciousness that rules. It's not matter.
Well, how do you define consciousness?
The physicists are now trying to define what consciousness is, but they can't quite do it yet.
Well, how do you define it? I mean, how would you attempt to define it, let's say?
I think that consciousness is the intelligence of the universe that's intrinsic in every aspect of it. And I think it's probably, is really what people and of various traditions have called God or spirit or truth or the higher source or whatever name has been given to it in different cultures. I think it's that intelligence, that loving intelligence of the whole of the universes, you know, the multiverses that are present here and beyond, that in other spheres that are not part of what we can observe as a material, a manifestation.
I like how you define that. So, go ahead, continue. Sorry.
Well, I just think that if we're seeing ourselves in what seems like the material manifestation, what we can see from quantum physics as well as from spiritual thought, that is not the real world. That's the illusory world. Why? Because what happens in this world, things are comprised of atoms, right?
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
Atoms are present in everything, the material world. And yet, in the big laboratory upstate New York where they crush atoms, you know what they find when they crush it? Nothing's there but a spark of energy.
So
and
the world...
Kind of, I get that one intellectually, but to really get it totally in my whole being is difficult. To realize that my body is not that real, it's just a spark of energy and all these material things around me. But if I can get that that's what happens when you crush an atom, it helps me understand there's a whole other dimension in the universes that's beyond what I comprehend and can see, where the true source of power really lies. And we're all part of that power. We just, in this condition, have the illusion that we're separate from it.
Right. I mean, that's a very evolved spiritual state, and I appreciate it and feel like I'm coming from that. But if someone is coming into you with their everyday problems, their relationships, and of course you're judging where they're at, how do you know, what signs do they give you to know if they're ready for to hear this? Because once you hear this, you sort of rise above your human drama a little bit.
Well, the first thing is that most everybody, almost every psychiatric condition that you put a label on, a diagnostic label, comes out of one basic problem, of powerlessness. And the powerlessness comes out of our illusion of separateness. And so a basic work, if a person comes in who's depressed, what is one of the major characteristics of that? One feels powerless and helpless. What about an anxiety? One feels powerless. That's why you feel anxious. When you're obsessive or when you're compulsive about something, why does one do that? Trying to feel some kind of control, some kind of power. So in a sense, all these labels we put on their various psychiatric conditions are just different expressions of one basic problem that we think we're separate from the all that is. And so when I work with people, I need to work from where they are to help them begin to gradually own some more of their own power, to own that their thoughts can make a difference. What it is that they're saying is instantly communicated to all 70 trillion cells in the body through the role of the neuropeptides, as Candace Pert discovered when she was at NIH.
And
she even said, your body is your subconscious mind, which means, okay, my body is just expressing a language that needs to be translated. And that's where the mind-body stuff comes in. And so our bodies are manifesting symptoms, not to take them to a doctor to get fixed, which is not bad thing to do. If you break a leg, you know, and you don't know how to heal it yourself, go get it fixed. But let's not stop there. Let's always be curious about what is the language saying here? What is every symptom saying? It's just a bit of communication that I find if I can translate it and interpret it and find a more constructive way of dealing with it, the symptoms tend to go away.
I think that's great, because you're saying that your body is playing out the actions of your subconscious mind. I think that gives us insight into how much we are this field of energy, and that the body's sort of representative of our emotional interactions with the environment.
And what our thoughts have been, what our beliefs have been.
So could you heal any condition then by healing the mind?
I'm sorry?
So when you wrote this book, Use Your Body to Heal Your Mind, how did you, what's your approach in that book?
Well, I wanted to really add a different subtitle than I put, but I thought it would scare people away, so I didn't put it there.
What did you want to say?
I wanted it to be Use Your Body to Heal Your Mind that needed the body to be sick.
Wait, the need of the body to be sick?
Use your body to heal the mind that needed the body to be sick.
That needed the body to be sick. And so and what would you say about that then? How would you deal with that?
What we call sickness is just a language to be translated. Mm-hmm. And if we can get to what it's about, I find the symptom does go away, whether it's a big thing or a little thing. I first learned that when I was in graduate school, actually. I'd had severe sore throats and colds several times a year from my age 15 to then about at age 25. And they were quite debilitating. And I was in Massachusetts at the time. I had a German Shepherd puppy that was getting bigger, and he was getting out of his fence. And I needed to repair the fence so he wouldn't go out and get run over in the highway nearby.
Yeah.
But it turned out it was one of those horrible wintry days in Massachusetts. It was 20-mile-an-hour wind and probably 15, 20 degrees, and it was snowing like crazy. And so I went out, and I was doing this work, and I started to get one of those sore throats. And I said in my best English, I said, "Oh, damn." But why? Because I knew what had happened in the past. And I get those. They always started that way, and it got to be pretty horrible and debilitating. And why was I upset? Because I was supposed to take comprehensive exams 2 days later on Monday. And I knew I wouldn't be in a good state to do it. And here I'd given up weekends to prepare myself for several months. And so I was really shaken by that. Then suddenly I thought, last semester I talked a professor into doing a directed study on the research in mind-body connection. And there were no courses in it at that time. But I discovered at that time they considered maybe half a dozen different things were mind-body connected. Ulcers, skin disorders, asthma, and maybe two or three other things. And I stood there in the yard that day and I thought, why would it be some parts of the body would be mind and body connected, but other parts exempt from it? That doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
That's the way the research was going at that time. That doesn't make sense at all. How could you separate out some parts of the body and connect them to mine and not others? Then I thought, okay, why might I need this cold right now? Started to ask myself those kind of questions. What would it get from me, or what would it get me out of? And of course, when I got to that part, I thought, well, maybe I want to get cold, so I get out of taking an exam. And then I realized, no, I don't want that. I spent months preparing for it and giving up my weekends of playtime with my family and friends. No, I want to have it done with so I can go back to enjoying my weekends again. And I thought, well, what is it then? And I kept asking questions, you know, why might I need it? What would it get for me? What would it get me out of? What emotion might be expressed in it? When I got to that one, I saw out of the corner of my eye my neighbor looking out of her kitchen window over my backyard, and I felt a deep pang of guilt. And I thought, well, I'm onto something here. I thought, what's that about? Then I thought, well, there she is. She's standing in the window, seeing me do this work for my dog out here in this horrible weather when I've not done something I promised to do for her father. Well, not that I was trying to get anything from her father. I was going to go over and do it on Tuesday after I took exams. I keep my word, so I wasn't trying to get out of doing it. But what I realized was more important. I projected onto her that she was standing there thinking those thoughts about me.
Right, and you didn't really know what she was really
thinking.
I
had no idea what she was thinking, or even if she saw me.
Right.
It made me fully aware of how much we human beings are all projecting all the time.
Yeah.
And so I caught my projection, and I thought, well, do I want to do that? I mean, just to have an excuse for not having done this for a father to make her feel better and whatever. I thought, no way. I just want this. I want to be well, and I want to take the exam. And I thought, well, how would I prefer to deal with this? And I thought, well, when I finish the work out here, I'll just go in the house and I'll pick up the phone and call her and just say, wanted you to know that I haven't forgotten your father. I'm taking comps on Monday, and I'll be over Tuesday. And just put it in perspective, got to get past my projection. Well, you know, within about 15 to 20 minutes, the sore throat and cold totally went away, and I've never had another one of those debilitating colds since.
Wait, so the cold was... It, what was it about? Feeling guilt or feeling projection? What caused it?
Well, the projection is what produced the guilt. Guilt is one emotion that goes just right straight into the body. It's one of the things that produces symptoms most quickly in the body is guilt.
So are you saying, and I do tend to believe it, anytime anyone gets sick or any kind of, interaction, it's something in their subconscious they're not haven't looked at. Would you
haven't
say
gotten
that?
Conscious of to deal with it differently, yeah.
And of course, there's patterns that then are deeper. And do you think that we get some of these patterns ancestrally as well that may not be ours consciously at all?
Sure. Oh, yeah, we may get something through the genes that we've passed on to us, or we may get something through what people call past lives. I don't know if that's literal or a metaphor, and I don't really care. But I remember some years ago when I was doing a session with a woman who had severe anxiety. And we worked for a while, and I'd studied most of the major forms of psychotherapy during and after I was studying to be a psychoanalyst. And I'd used everything I knew, and nothing was working with her anxiety. And one day she came in and said to me, Henry, I think I was born with this. And I thought, well, I don't know. That's true, but I'd learned how to do muscle testing from applied kinesiology, and that your arm becomes stronger if you know a statement to be true, and it goes weak if you know it to be false. So I thought, what the heck, I'll try it. And so I went over and tested her arm, and the statement, this problem of my anxiety came from some ancestor, some genetic memory. Her arm became very strong. And I said, it did not come from a genetic memory. Her arm became very weak. So I thought, okay, we're on to something. I said, there was one genetic memory, the arm was strong. There were two genetic memories, the arm was strong. There were three genetic memories, the arm was strong. There are four genetic memories, it went weak. So I said, okay, we got three pieces of DNA information there. I'd never read anything about how you can do anything to change it. I know in the new field of epigenetics I've learned about since that we're not locked into our genes. And epigenetics is what's above the genes. And that genes can be activated or deactivated. But I didn't know that theory at that time. So I thought, I can't lose anything. And it can't hurt anything to try. So I'd learned thought-field therapy at that time and algorithms for trauma. So I thought, let me just try one of those, which is one of the meridian tapping exercises, one of the original ones, actually, that Roger Callahan came up with, a psychologist in California.
Right, the Callahan tapping technique, EFT,
yeah.
Yes.
And he was one of the first ones to do that, to move past acupuncture needing needles. And so I tried that on the person, and we did a clearing around the first genetic memory, then the second genetic memory, and the third one. And she went home and felt better, she said, and then she came back the next week. She was absolutely glowing. She said, Henry, you won't believe it. I said, what? She said, I am free of anxiety for the first time in my whole life that I ever remember. I've been happy this week.
Wow.
And I thought, wow, she just taught me something really important, that we can go back with conscious intent and use some kind of principle that uses a heightened focus of intentionality, and the tapping helps do that, as well as stimulate the meridians. But I think it's more of a ritual to give a heightened focus of intentionality, since consciousness rules. And so I learned from that, gee, we have a lot more potentiality than we think we have. We're not locked into our and doomed to our past genetic structure. And then since then, I remember reading an experiment where you take a strain of DNA and put it in a petri dish in the laboratory and look at it through a microscope, then you have somebody come into the room and think angry thoughts or anxious thoughts or worry thoughts, that strain of DNA starts to tighten up and not puts itself into a tight knot, you know, a tall, tight ball.
Right.
If you have somebody come into the room and think loving thoughts, compassionate thoughts, happy, joyous thoughts, that strain of DNA relaxes and unfolds and just stretches out in the most relaxed position. And I thought, wow, that's the idea of consciousness ruling, and the genes do not rule, but consciousness rules more than the genes.
So as you went into this work, and it sounds like you were fascinated with this connection, what have you learned about the soul level? I'm just curious about that and the soul's reason, because obviously the soul creates these illnesses or even like a sore throat to have an experience so the conscious mind can learn something about this reality. How do you look at that?
Well, I think one spiritual work that I've gotten a lot from is A Course in Miracles, which you've probably heard of.
Yes, of course, yes.
And one thing it says is that everyone who comes here to the earth in this human form comes because they want to experience illusion. When I first read that, I thought, why in the world would I want that? Why would I want to come here to experience illusions? But then I realized that, okay, that's really what this world is about. It's just full of illusions. And it's even in our country, it's even proclaimed, you know, we come here to carry out the American dream, which is
right.
just
it's
the world
dream.
Of illusion again.
It's
or in our
dream.
Preamble to the constitutions, we have the rights to life and liberty and the pursuit of happiness, not happiness. To be chasing
funny.
After something outside that would do it. So apparently, what I take from that is that whatever souls are, and whatever dimension it is, for some reason, that we wanted to experience illusion and learn something from it, that we are much more than that. And I do not understand to this day why we chose that or why we needed that if we were in this other realm. Maybe someday I will. But I know that my task here is to learn not to give value to my illusions, that it's really my attachment to any of them. As the Buddha pointed out 2,600 years ago, that's a cause of all of our suffering is attachment.
Well, it seems like maybe you do know it. If, let's say, you understand why you created that sore throat is to learn the lessons, I mean, I'm just guessing, of the thought projections, you actually learned an understanding, a deeper truth about the experience of intention and unconsciousness in that little experience you shared.
Well, that's true. And each time I've had either an accident that injured me or in some way, or any illness, whether it's been a significant one or an insignificant one, I've always had the opportunity to learn something from it.
Right, so we're here to learn, right? I mean, we can learn maybe the difficult way, or maybe we don't have to go through those lessons. Somebody said to me, we're not here to learn the lessons. We're here to get the message. If you don't get the message, then you learn the lessons.
we resist the learning it, and that's what creates a lot of the problems, that then we have to get the lesson and finally learn to get past it. Yes.
Yeah, but we could get it directly if we just would listen, I suppose, but we're stubborn and attached. But
well, that's one thing the Course in Miracles says too, is that we human beings can tolerate immense amounts of suffering and pain, but it also says we don't have to do that. It says we can be what it calls the happy learner.
Right. I agree. Now, in your book, Mindful Loving, 10 Practices for Creating Deeper Consciousness, what do you mean by deeper consciousness? Is this what you mean?
Well, the deeper consciousness would be remembering who we really are and learning from all of these other kind of lessons that we have and our attachments. And like in relationships, that's where one of the first things we do is we make people special and we get attached to that idea about them. Make up the specialness about them, about what they will be for us, what they can give to us, what they can do for me, how it will make me feel and how they can make me happy. Well, all of that's the start of pain, because my happiness cannot come from anything external. It can only come from my own mind.
But it seems like such a, I mean, that's transcultural. Every human being sort of does that. You know,
yeah.
Here's this person for me. They're special because then I'm special. How do we ever transcend that?
Well, we can have more and more moments of doing it. I'm
yeah.
not perfect at it, but I can do it a lot more now than I could 10 years ago, and a whale of a lot more than I could 20 years ago, and I expect to get better at it next year.
But you want to keep loving. It's not about not loving, is it?
It's more about being love, not getting love.
Oh. Wait, so say a little bit more about that in terms of relationships?
Because in most special relationships, we're seeking love. We're trying
we
to
want
get
something
love,
for us.
Barter for it.
Oh, so I'm in this relationship with somebody because I want them to love me because I'm needing that. Is that what you're saying? That's why people go to relationships.
Even though we might not do it that directly, but that's really what we're playing out in most of our relationships. Until we catch it and learn that, no, my role here is just to be love. If I'm part of the divine, if I'm part of what we call God, or if I am a child of God, as the language is used a lot in Christian Jewish tradition, or in the creation story, if I'm created in the image and likeness of God, okay, that means I am love. I just forget it most of the time. And I
so
think I need to get it out there.
So you say we're here in relationships then to give love.
To be it. Mm-hmm.
To be it. What do you exactly mean by being love? How would you describe that? Or how would you be it? Because I'm not exactly sure what you mean.
That means I'm seeing a person who needs love and I want to extend it. I'm seeing in other people that whatever they're not, when they're not being loving and they're not being kind or they may be being cruel, if I can see it as an appeal for love, a desperate appeal for love, that provides an opportunity for me to be that. I find when I can be that more to people, they actually often heal. They heal from their pain or their fear or their suffering if they have that experience of feeling the love.
Is that really the job of a
therapist? But that happens anywhere.
But is that the job? Would you? I mean, I would say that's unusual for therapists. Would you say that's really the job of a therapist?
To be love?
Yeah.
I think it's the job of humanity. Therapy is just one place to be it.
And
our job while we're here in the body to learn that that's who and what I am, and that's where the true power lies.
Wow. I like that. That's very, it's very, you know, heroic in a sense to be loved.
If I'm a store clerk, or if I'm a therapist, or if I'm a doctor, or I'm a lawyer, or I'm a bus driver, or whatever it might be, that's the place for me to be love and loving kindness.
Now, how'd you learn that? Because that's not the general attitude for, you know, a bus driver or a therapist. Is that something you always had, or did you actually get that somewhere or learn it or be it?
I've studied so many spiritual works and traditions, and I find that the core of most of them say the same thing there. Get to it one way or another. That seems to be an essential, you know, teaching.
When you saw it, you realized when was the first time you actually tried that as a therapist to be love, and what was the result of that?
I can't say I have a specific memory of the first time I tried that.
Okay.
It's been more of a gradual kind of thing, because I think from the first time of working with people, I would feel kind of compassion and caring, you know, and want to be of help. Unfortunately, when I first started out, I wanted that too much. I felt like I should fix everybody in about, you know, 10 weeks flat. And so I'd go home at the end of the day just totally wiped out and exhausting and aching down my legs from tiredness, feeling like I had to fix everybody. And then I came to realize I was playing out some old stuff from my childhood, and I worked that out in my own therapy, and I let go of that, and I found when I stopped trying to fix everybody, people got better much faster and developed their own strength more. And I didn't get so tired by the end of the day. And then gradually through the studying of various spiritual works, I realized that, no, I'm not really the therapist. It's really what we call spirit or higher consciousness or God or whatever word you'd want to use for it. It's that other dimension of higher consciousness in the universe that is the true therapist. I can just be a channel of it. And if I trust that, I don't really have to work at all. I just let it flow through me. And what I found, things will come out of my mouth I never thought of saying, or in such a way, or I can use things that I've learned in ways I hadn't thought of using them before. And they click and they help some way in a person that I never imagined could happen. And then at the end of the day, I'm more energized than I started out the day. Because I'm not struggling and working from a little ego level anymore. Because that's not where the healing comes from.
And then you weren't so attached to from getting better or not. You were just doing what you were there to do, right?
And that's what brings the healing.
So what's synergetic therapy that you use? What's that about?
Well, synergy means, you know, that the sum of the parts is much more powerful than each individual part, is the basic definition of synergy. And since I've studied most of the major forms of psychotherapy, I was originally trained as a psychoanalyst. And then while I was there, I began to realize, even in my own analysis, as well as my work with patients, it was very helpful in a lot of ways. But it didn't touch all problem areas in me, nor with my patients. And there were other areas that I found something else would be helpful, like cognitive therapy, or behavior therapy, or hypnosis, or gestalt therapy, or body-based things that were, like bioenergetics. And I began to learn these various ones. And fortunately, I had an analyst, a training analyst, who instead of labeling me as acting out, she just took those things, I brought them back into my sessions, and she just wove it right in with me, and it helped me grow like I never would have grown just by psychoanalysis alone.
So she helped you integrate those other skills, you're saying?
Just helped me work it in, you know, into my own work, in my own growth. And so when I saw how it worked for me in my work with her, that's what prompted me to begin to do that with my patients. I thought, yes, I can weave these things in with them too, as it makes sense. And I've done that ever since, because I've always felt like I really want to find any way that will help people be free of their pain and find joy and health faster, as long as it's legal and ethical and has no harmful side effects.
Why was that so important to you, to help people be free of their pain? I mean, just curious.
I do not know how it originated.
Well,
I
that's
don't know
honest.
Where it started. I just know that I felt I wanted to do that.
Well, I mean, that's great, because like you said, you're probably just a channel for that love. So how did you start or think of starting an Association for Spirituality and Psychotherapy, ASP? That's what these talks are being sponsored by, these interviews. So talk about your ideas in founding that and how that came about.
Well, it came about after I'd gotten into quantum physics and that awakening with David Bohm. And that opened up the spiritual dimension for me. And then I thought, well, most therapists just don't even allow this at all in their practice or with their patients to deal with the spiritual dimension. And I thought, this needs to be brought to the surface. So it started out before the association, many years before, that I thought, be good to have a division of the National Institute for the Psychotherapists, which I'd founded some decades before that. And I said, brought it to the board, and it totally surprised me that the board unanimously approved setting up a division of NIP to be the Center for Spirituality and Psychotherapy.
And then I
kicked it off by putting on a conference on that theme. And it drew about 300 people.
They
were so moved by it. They kept coming up and just saying, thank you, thank you, thank you. I needed this. I needed this place. I was so embarrassed or afraid to talk about it with colleagues. Now I know colleagues I can talk about my spiritual life with. And they were just, you know, that's the way the whole thing started. Then it gradually moved toward becoming a membership association.
Right. I know my uncle, George. You know George, right?
Steinfeld.
Yeah, he was an influence on me, opening up to this world of spirituality, and he was very excited about that possibility, because This whole movement towards spirituality, you know, the biggest trend now among the youth is called spiritual but not religious. So there's a movement towards this understanding of spirituality, and we need more and more therapists that can understand that we are more than our bodies, that there's a higher connection. So,
well, I think one movement in that direction just the last few years has been the word mindfulness.
Yeah.
Now, that was originally ascribed only to meditation, but now it's permeated the whole field of psychology, and it's just a buzzword everywhere about mindfulness. And use that, it made it more palatable to therapists to use that when they couldn't think of meditation. And then on top of that, now, the last 3 years, there have been 4 conferences put at Harvard Medical School on psychotherapy and meditation.
Oh, really? Oh,
and
I didn't know that.
That has been a remarkable kind of trend, that one of our leading medical schools has put on four such conferences.
Uh-huh. So the mindfulness, how does that relate to spirituality? When you say mindfulness or people use it, is that just awareness, present awareness? Or
well, that's the way they're using it in psychology now. But, of course, we know that as one becomes more mindful of one's thoughts, That's a basic spiritual practice.
Yes.
And if I can be mindful of the thoughts that cause me pain and suffering, you know, or guilt or agony or suspicion or mistrust or whatever it is, and if I can be aware of those thoughts and just let them pass by or have some technique I use for letting them go, I'm going to change my whole brain. I'm going to change my whole life. Well, that is a central spiritual practice, is meditation.
Mm.
And so whether you call it spiritual or not, being mindful or practicing meditation, in fact, just last month, or is it this month, the leading story in Scientific American magazine is on meditation.
Wow, it's taken this long. I mean, meditation first came on the scene in the West anyway in the 70s, or 60s really, with the Beatles, the TM movement,
right.
And now
it's a cover story on Scientific American this month.
Well, that's good. I mean, social movements take time, and this is just one of them. So when you started the Association for Spirituality and Psychotherapy as a separate organization when you created that from NIP?
Well, it started out at NIP as a center for spirituality and psychotherapy. And then after several years, we decided to move it out and let it be a national membership organization instead.
And it still is that.
It's kind of fulfilled its purpose largely.
It has. I think it can evolve, and I think those series of these talks are maybe pointing away to another incarnation of it, maybe as an online reference site or something like
that.
Some
other way of expressing it. We'll see what evolves, yes.
But I'm just curious, now you're moved on to something else. Can you talk about what you're involved with now?
Well, what I'm interested in now is what I call what you referred to before as a synergetic therapy.
Yeah.
Because most of the places that teach therapy are teaching a singular modality.
Oh, I see.
And I think that there's a need for bringing them the best of each all together. And that's the way that you can best help people. Because you can take what works to help a person with their negative belief or with their trauma, you know, or with their depression or anxiety. But they're from various of these traditions. They're wonderful tools you can bring together into one unified framework. And it helps people change and grow, I think, so much faster than if you limit yourself to just one of them.
But aren't you involved in some building another organization, I thought, in some ways?
I'm working on a program to do that, and that, I'm not sure, it's not clear yet whether it would be under the auspices of NIP or whether it would be separate.
Oh, I see.
We're negotiating that right now as to which would be best.
Well, there's so many therapies that are synergistic. What's another one that you work with that you like to use?
Well, the new ones that are so powerful are, I think, ones that are for clearing traumas and for clearing out negative beliefs, for clearing out unremembered traumas and childhood, even intrauterine traumas or first year of life traumas or genetic memories would be this whole category of energy psychology, which is really largely meridian stimulation or chakra stimulation with consciousness, or bilateral brain stimulation, which can be some of the energy might flow over and do some of both, like thought field therapy does both. It's meridian stimulation and bilateral brain stimulation.
I mean, I've done some EFT. I don't quite, even though I've studied acupuncture, I don't quite understand how tapping on acupuncture points releases some trauma from the body. Do you understand it? I mean, I'm curious.
I think of several things. One is I've made a variation on EFT that I think it makes it more powerful, that instead of tapping, I have people touch the acupressure points and take very deep breaths with each one, which calms down the limbic system, which is what, you know, is behind the traumas in there going on. And then to make the statement as to what emotion they're releasing that has to do with that acupressure point. Mm-hmm. And in the ancient system of acupuncture, each meridian, according to this Chinese history, is attached to a different bodily organ. And that organ represents a set of negative emotions and the opposite positive emotions. And so they believe if you stimulated that meridian with the needles, that then you would deactivate the negative emotion and allow the positive one to come in and replace it.
Right.
And I think to some degree that happens through meridian stimulation. But I think it's also a ritual that's unusual that helps people give a heightened focus of consciousness. And so one thing I find powerful about it is you have the breath work that I've added to it. You have the meridian stimulation. You have the statement as to what emotion you're releasing. And I find when the person touches that acupoint and they make that statement, sometimes it brings into consciousness emotion that they never knew they felt. Like, I didn't know I felt so angry about this. I didn't know I felt so shame or guilt about it, and so on. All those together, I think, they just work in different ways, you know, to do a focus of heightened conscious intent. Or it may be just some bilateral stimulation. One simple one might be just sitting down and tapping on opposite legs with your fingers and just going back and forth while you're focusing on something you want to release. Even that in itself, or tapping on the opposite biceps of your body, you know, or your eyes going back and forth left and right. You're doing bilateral brain stimulation, which means the left brain and the right brain process more information through that little ribbon connection there that connects the brain, and maybe just process it a little bit more. But it's also just an unusual ritual that helps focus the consciousness. I also find if you use certain kinds of music that slow the brain waves down, you know, from beta waves down to alpha or theta or even delta brain waves, sometimes doing that combined with the process puts you into this state where you loosen up that structure inside, allow the releasing of it more, and if you want to install new software, you can do it more readily, just like we did in the preschool years. So there are all sorts of ways I think we can enhance our growth and learning from these various systems, I guess is what I'm saying.
Right, and it's very exciting as new people create these new therapies to go deeper, release more trauma. But what it seems to come down to, what you said before, like I didn't know I felt that way, is acknowledging how sensitive we are as human beings and telling the truth to ourselves about what we're feeling. That seems to be at a core of a lot of issues there.
It brings it up into consciousness then,
Yeah.
And then bring it into consciousness to release it.
And that, in a way, that sets us free. The truth of our feelings sets us free.
It helps to do that. And I think we know what happens with traumas. They remain as encoded information in our survival brain. And it's supposed to be there to protect the caveman from a tiger or a snake. But that part of our brain, as one neuroscientist put it to me, he says, you've heard the statement, once bitten, twice shy. He says, that's a gross understatement. He says, that part of our brain is 15 to 18 times more active than it needs to be for our stage of evolution.
Wait, I don't understand. Are you saying the survival traumatized part of our brain is more active than it needs to be?
Right. And that just means we need to use more tools to deal with it. And that's why I think breathing exercises help with it, meditation helps with it, doing these energy clearings, you know, helps with it. Because if I can clear out the information in that part of the brain, which is like clearing information out of a computer, and if I can do enough of that, I reduce the stress hormones from flowing. When I reduce the stress hormones from flowing and I get more oxygen to the brain, I can think more creatively. When I do that, I can open myself to more love and to more peace and more joy and more kindness. I can allow the spiritual growth to take place more if I don't have myself being held back by the intense secretion of cortisol and adrenaline.
But are we more trauma-prone than we think we are? Because, you know, we might get yelled at when we're a child, and that creates a deep-seated trauma. That's what comes to me.
Exactly.
So we have to treat each other with more kindness to prevent.
We sure need that. The world needs that.
But how do we pull that trauma out of us if it's so deeply embedded? And it's embedded
in
all
of us. If you think about it this way, the brain is a prototype of the computer.
Yes.
So if you look at the computer, it tells you a little bit about how the brain works. And
like,
if you've got programs in your computer that gum it up and keep it from working well, what do? You press the delete button on it. And you press enough delete buttons, your computer works well again. We can do the same thing with our brains.
But if we didn't know we had the program and we were acting as in a sense, a manifestation of our personality, then we don't even know we're traumatized. We don't even know we have the program.
Yeah, and we think that I'm reacting to this person over there because of what they did. No, I'm reacting to it because of what they represent from my past pain history.
Right, so how do we, I guess you've talked about how we free ourselves from it then, right?
Yeah, that's why I like these new tools, because they can help us free ourselves from it. Exactly.
And so the overall, I mean, so you're always evolving your work, it seems like. You haven't stopped learning more about, you know, how to help people. And is there a time where you feel like you've completed that, or is this like still such a passionate part of your life?
Well, even this center this program in synergetic therapy, what I'd want to teach in that is for people to continually keep that spirit of openness and growth.
Mm.
So if they want to learn the synergy I have at this point, not to make a doctrine out of it like they have everybody else that created a therapy.
Right.
You know, to make a doctrine out of it, then it becomes doctrinaire like in religions.
Uh-huh.
And so, no, let's not get stuck there. Let's not make doctrines in psychology and psychotherapy, like just not make doctrines in religion either. Let's move past that. Let's continue to grow and be open and to find what's going to be most helpful to people, to find their true self.
But you're saying synergetic approaches go beyond talk therapy, but sometimes talk therapy is effective, right?
Oh, yes, right. There's a place for it. Yes. To be understood, to be heard, to be responded to feel a caring presence. Oh, that's very healing, yes.
Right. And so the synergetic therapies are more of these mind-body activity therapies, you're saying?
No, it's including all of it.
Uh-huh, including talk therapy.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
I mean, so at the core of human beings' problems is this disconnection, like you said in the beginning of the show, this fear, this trauma. How are we ever going to evolve beyond all this into like a new age of consciousness? Is there a way? Is there a time?
Well, I think every person who has some more awareness, it radiates that out to others around.
Mm.
And
so what's,
if I'm changing myself, then it's going to radiate around to people around me. And if you're doing that, and Joe Blow is doing that, and Susie Q is doing that, then that helps bring consciousness up to another level.
So what's the change that you've seen since you started, I guess, in the 60s to now? What have you noticed globally, locally, nationally, along those lines?
I see more and more people being recognizing the power of the mind. I see more people being interested in doing something with their minds, like to practice meditation or breathing. I see the practice of yoga increasing, and they're doing it in gyms all over the place. They're not seeing it in most of the places. It was originally created as a preparation for meditation. But I think it's a start because it's kind of a quasi meditation. You have to focus and breathe and to do your exercises, your asanas. So it's all a start. It's a movement. Like India is going the opposite direction, for example. There's hardly any place, you know, that teaches and practices yoga much over there anymore. Right. Meditation is going way, way down.
I spoke
in New Delhi at a conference a few years ago, and I sat next to one of their leading businessmen who was very spiritual. And he's spending money and writing books now and trying to bring back spirituality to India, which is amazing.
Yeah, well, they're looking to compete with the West and go up to the West. But I think we're all coming into balance. I think the internet creating a global village will eventually bring balance and help evolve us to something new.
And just like now in China, you know, there's not much to do with Qigong and stuff in a lot of places, but there's still many people practicing it in the parks every morning before they go to work. And now it's spreading over here, and they're realizing that even those exercises are kind of meditating. They help you get more centered, more relaxed in the slow movements in the consciousness. And you're harnessing energy systems of life energy called Qi.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So there's a spread that's going on, yes.
One therapy I'm interested in, I don't know that much about it, but I heard it's EMDR. Can you talk about that a little bit? Because that sounds very interesting.
That's what I was referring to as bilateral brain stimulation.
Oh, okay. How does that work?
It's the most common known part of it, but there are others that are using bilateral brain too. Francine Shapiro originally came across it because she discovered her eye movements back and forth seemed to make her not feel as upset about something. And then she started doing research on it and had her doctoral students do studies, and that popularized it. But we now know that there are a variety of ways you can do bilateral brain stimulation, and EMDR is just the most popular, best known, because it had a lot of publications about it, and that popularized it.
What does EMDR say in certain traumas, your eyes get stuck in certain positions too? Is that there? Are they talking about that?
Not so much in EMDR. There's an outgrowth from it called brain spotting where they do that.
Oh, brain spotting,
yes. And brain spotting does that, where they do very slow movements of the eye around, very, very slowly. And if your eye kind of blinks at some point or you kind of cut off a circle at some point, then they hold the pointer there to just focus on it more, and you keep holding and breathing, holding and breathing. Then they find at a certain point you probably have a catharsis about whatever is encoded in that part of the brain.
I see. So that brain-body position...
Brain spotting, they call it,
Yeah, but I'm just saying overall, these new therapies that are connecting the brain to emotions, to physiology, to illness, they're integrating the whole human being. And this is
much more,
really what we've needed all along.
One of the new ones that's emerging is called somatic experiencing. And that's not so different from bioenergetics or gestalt therapy in the years past, where you had to focus on different body parts and breathe into them and let the consciousness of that emotion emerge. So there are all these things going on that help us kind of get to what the body is containing.
Well, it's great to talk to you because it seems like you're fascinated by people and the psychology of their being is what I sense from you.
Well, the psychology of their being and to uncover our essential spiritual nature.
I guess I want to ask, therapy is one way, but therapy also, the psychology seems to be almost in the way of the true nature, because psychology has to do with personality, and what you're saying or what you're after, what I get, is beyond the personality.
Yes, I'm more than my personality.
But you have to deal with the personality through psychology to go beyond it, right?
Yes and no.
Okay.
You have to deal with what a person's experiencing. We don't have to make that personality identity the be-all, end-all, which is what a psychology does. But we don't have to focus on that part and make it so real. We can make it much more real, the idea of focusing on what's letting go of what's not real. And in a sense, all of our pain is not real. All of our sickness is not real. We've made it real, and therefore we suffer. Well, but if we can gradually find tools we can use to let that go, we realize it's not ruling me. It does not have the power. My power lies inside me. As I begin to realize I have more power, then I can gradually begin to realize that is my essential nature. That's my spiritual self.
Well, this is what makes your work and, of course, the work of the members of the ASP different, because they realize that we're not dealing with a personality which will always create some kind of neurosis or need, because people come from that, attached place. That's what psychology is about, in a sense. And so transcending that is transcending the individual needs or the neediness, and being, like you said, being love. I mean, that's what I get.
Exactly. Exactly.
So this seems still a long way from psychology, mainstream psychology, that's still teaching a kind of personality psychology.
Even in the things like cognitive behavior therapy, while it's so valuable to catch one's thoughts, which leads us towards spiritual things, but it's not the be-all by itself.
But
and
this
is, I think, that in psychology, it's made to be.
But this is the next. I mean, for me, it seems like what you're saying, what the essence of ASP and their members, is that there is something more to the human being than their psychology. And that's what we need to integrate into the totality of the society. It's taken us a long time, in a sense, to recognize the value of psychology. I mean, before the 1900s, no one ever dealt with psychology. Now,
William James, the founder of modern psychology, was actually quite spiritual.
Yes, he was.
But then after the Second World War came the movement to try to make psychology more scientific. And unfortunately, what they call scientific was based more on Newtonian physics. That's science. Yeah. Rather than on quantum physics, that science. And so still most of the research in psychology and in medicine is based on the 350-year-old science rather than the new science, or spirituality, which is more related to the new physics.
But you know what makes you different, and even William James and the people who are now opening up to a spiritual psychology, is that you've had an experience. You know, you knew you were more than your body, more than your personality, and I think a lot of people have yet to have that experience, and that's what I think makes the difference between maybe us and them, if we want to put it that way.
Just having an experience here and there where we let that awareness come in.
Yeah. But I think the more you plant, people like you and these organizations plant seeds, people who may not recognize the experience can actually start to connect something to it. And then the movement and the mindful awareness of that we are consciousness starts to expand. And it is, like you said, it is expanding. So there's hope for a huge change. And I thank you so much for being an instrument, a part, an initiator of these awakened awarenesses.
That's what I feel I'm supposed to do. I teach it, it helps me to awaken more, and I feel more joyful when I see people awaken more themselves. Nothing can be more fulfilling to me than that.
Well, thank you, Henry. Thank you, Henry Grayson, for your contribution to the world. Any final words? Anything you'd like to promote? Anything coming up? Your website, henrygrayson.com, but anything coming up that you would like to add to this, or projects or something that you would like to leave people with?
Well, I do speak in different places or locations around at different times, and so those can be listed on my website, can find them there if they're interested in that, and they're training seminars that were offered more intensively at various times and places in different parts of the country. And so
training for therapists
right now, because I'm focusing more on starting this bigger training program And so I'm focusing more energy on that right now, whereas I used to travel a lot more on weekends doing intensive weekend seminars. But I still do some of those. And right now I'm just trying to get this other training program off the ground.
Are these trainings for therapists or for anyone?
This training that I'm working on now is for therapists. The ones that I did on weekends, mostly therapists would attend, but probably maybe 25% would be other people who are not therapists coming to them.
So this training that you're doing, this synergetic therapy training, is that what you're talking about?
I think that people can learn to use these tools with themselves. They can learn to use them with family members or friends. Not in the same way a skilled therapist can do, but they can use it as first aid measure. It can help them immensely get past different parts of pain or discomfort or anxiety, you know, or fears and so on. And so I'd like to see a wider spread use of it, both in the therapy situation where it can be done in depth and more thoroughly, but also just people can use it individually just to release pain and suffering and feel better.
Well, thank you. It sounds great. We're going to put this up on the ASP website, this interview, but of course, you know, feel free to, you know, to pass this on and use this for your own purposes, you know, what we've talked about here. So I appreciate your input. Thank you.
Well, it's been fun talking with you.
Well, yeah, I hardly knew that much about you, and I realize how dedicated and passionate you are to this integration of mind and spirit, and I think it's great. You know, it's beautiful.
Well, I see it as really our fine movements to help us get past the egoic mind and find more of who we truly are.
Yeah, and that's, of course, why we came here in the first place, you know.
Yes, to experience that egoic mind so we can get fed up with it.
Yeah. Thanks, Henry.
Thank you, too.
Okay.
And thanks for inviting me, and wish you every good thing.
Thank you. I'll be in touch. I'll let you know when we're posting this, and ASP will be in touch with you as well. Okay?
Okey-doke.
Okay. I've been talking to Henry Grayson, who's really one of the revolutionaries of mind, body, spirit. He calls himself an integrative mind, body psychotherapist. He is the founder of the Association for Psychotherapies, now doing a bunch of other things. It's been a very interesting interview. You can reach him at henrygrayson.com. My name's Alan Steinfeld for New Realities. And if you want to reach me, go to my website, newrealities.com. Thanks for listening tonight, and good night.